بيا راح شفاني سفيا هي نالي بيا وجهني بالنية عليا وراي مهرها بيه يوم راح شفاني سفيا هي نالي بيا وجهني بالنية هي
راي
هرمو يا وراي مثل فني وين راح ظهري مكتوب علي وراي وابو غزالي ورحمه والليلي وهو وهذا هو سعدي وهذا طريق مكتوب بيه
راي راي
هرمو راي مثل الفريح وهو
هرمو
وين راح ظهريه يا
راي هرمو
راي مثل الفريح وهو
هرمو
راح ظهريه
And once again, that was a track from the Putumayo Arabic Beat album, which is the second album in the series. The can't recall the title of the original CD, but I know. Here we go. Arabic Beat features more of the upbeat Middle Eastern and North African dance music that made Arabic Groove a global success. First album was entitled Arabic Groove. This is Arabic Beat. And you just heard track 9 from Zain Al-Jundi, Ajmal Gharam. Ajmal Gharam apparently hails from Syria. Native of Syria. Okay, let's do this. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for, what do we got? January 26, 2015. I have to repeat that information because I'm starting my recording of this program from scratch now. From a Palestine News, Palestine. Gaza says readying seaport for international travel. Why did I choose to render this piece on to my listeners here? For those in the know, the other weekly edition of Mideast Migraines which is every Saturday starting at 11 o'clock a.m. has been taken up, actually, for the last 14 months by readings of important books having to do with the situation in Palestine / Israel, or Israel / Palestine. It's remarkable how upset people can become merely at which character you give top billing to. At any rate, I'm, for the past couple of months, been in the process of reading to you Freedom Sailors, which is the true story of the first non-military voyages of any seagoing vessels, the first two trips by sea In 41 years into the Gaza Strip from outside of the Gaza Strip, since Israel took over the Strip in 1967, in the summer of 2008, I and 43 other intrepid human rights workers sailed into the port of Gaza City from Cyprus, and that is what the book Freedom Sailors is about. So tying in with the latest chapters that I've been reading, this is from Palestine News Palestine. Gaza says it is readying a seaport for international travel. From yesterday, Palestine News staff. A ministerial committee in Israeli-blockaded Gaza announced plans on Sunday to ready the enclave's sole seaport, that is, at the city, at Gaza City, the enclave's sole seaport to allow Palestinians to travel abroad. The enclave, home to 1.8 million people, has been under an Israeli land and sea blockade since 2006. Its sole gateway to the world, not controlled by Israel, is the Rafah border with Egypt, which has been largely closed since late October. Ala al-Bata, spokesman for the committee formed to lift the blockade, said preparations are underway to launch, within 2 months, a boat service for the sick and students studying overseas. The seaport in Gaza City is currently restricted to fishermen, whom Israel occupation forces only allows to fish up to a maximum of 6 nautical miles from the shore. And let me add that that distance from shore ranges roughly between 3 and 6 nautical miles, and generally at the whim of the Israeli Navy do the changes occur. Continuing with this news dispatch now, Israeli occupation forces routinely fire on any vessel close to the outer limit, whichever limit is currently in play, and just close to it, let alone at it or going outside of it. Continuing, opening a seaport was one of the main Palestinian demands to be tabled during negotiations with Israel, with the Israel entity to firm up a truce agreement which ended a 50-day war in July and August. But the negotiations failed to get off the ground and the demand was never tabled. Quote, we are taking the necessary measures to allow maritime transport and to prepare for the construction of a port which will link Gaza with the outside world, Bata said. We're taking the to allow maritime transport. There was no immediate reaction from Israel to the Gaza seaport plan. Several ships manned by pro-Palestinian activists have tried to run the blockade and reach the shores of Gaza, but they have all been repelled by the Israeli occupation navy. In 2010, Israeli occupation commandos staged a botched raid on a 6-ship flotilla in international waters, killing 10 Turkish nationals and sparking a diplomatic crisis with Ankara that has yet to be resolved. Again, that dispatch from AFP, Palestine News Palestine. A few clarifications here. And this is another one of those translations into English, which is not all that masterful. There was no immediate reaction from Israel to the Gaza seaport plan. However, I will point out that sometime last year, after a several-month-long effort, more like a year or two-long effort in planning and an implementation, after a lot of work was done to rehabilitate one of the larger local fishing vessels in the port of Gaza City, and very shortly before, the vessel was due to be christened. Israel blew it up. There was no secret about this operation, even if Hamas or anyone in the Gaza Strip wanted to keep this operation a secret, it would have been impossible. But they've been completely open about the fact that the intention was to send this boat off with passengers, Palestinian Gazans, to visit family who were outside of the Gaza Strip, who were not in Israel, but elsewhere, Cyprus, Greece, wherever, or to study abroad or to get medical assistance, as many, many Palestinians are not permitted. When it comes right down to it, they're just flat out not permitted to go through the land gates between Gaza and Israel, or between Gaza and Egypt, even if they're in dire need of medical assistance. Many of them die not being able to get through those gates. And the Gaza's Ark project, which I'm describing, was intended to serve this purpose. And it was blown up very shortly, as I said, under cover of night, by Israeli commandos, no doubt. And a phone call was received by the watchman on board that he'd better get off the boat because something was going to happen. And he left the boat and 5 minutes later came back, nothing having happened. And then, boom, an explosion, which did not succeed in sinking the vessel, but severely damaged it and put the project way, way back along its timetable. And the Gaza's Ark project people have been taking it from there. So we have a situation where Israel, and that is not the only time where Israel has blown up a vessel, either due to carry or currently carrying Palestinians or others in solidarity with the Palestinian people. 1988, a much larger vessel was exploded. I believe it was still moored or parked on the island of Cyprus with the intention of heading to Haifa, Israel, so the Palestinians that it would be carrying would touch base with their homeland. And the Israeli commandos set an explosive or used a mine or something and scuttled that project. And the other thing is, there's absolutely no reason for Israel to to do this in either case. In the case of Gaza's Ark, the situation was exactly as I described, fully open. Its itinerary, its agenda was open to the world. Israel knew about it. It was simply to enhance the lives and livelihoods of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, and Israel still messed up things for them. It is remarkable how utterly cavalier and downright savage the so-called Israeli Defense Forces can be in these dastardly actions. So, but we have the statement here, there was no immediate reaction from Israel to the Gaza seaport plan. That reaction may come in a violent, very violent physical manner shortly. You see, there's a color photo here of what appears to be, I'm not sure if this is photoshopped at all, but various Palestinian men are standing arm on shoulder here in front of a stone building with what actually to me looks very much like it could be a photoshopped imposition of the words in Arabic and in English, Gaza seaport. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's actually up there and says what it says. Even if it were a fully actually constructed building with a marquee or wording on its face, it would, at this point in time, it would be nothing more than a building with the words Gaza seaport on it, because the seaport has a long ways to go before it is developed, assuming Israel will allow the Gazans to build the thing and turn it into an operating seaport on the Mediterranean Sea. And as it says here, we are taking the necessary measures to allow maritime transport and to prepare for the construction of a port which will link Gaza with the outside world. And then they mention the thing that I've been reading about on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. There was several ships manned by pro-Palestinian activists have tried to run the blockade and reach the shores of Gaza, but they have all been repelled by the Israeli occupation navy. Let me add a correction there. All the attempts by individual boats and by the Free Gaza movements and associated movements flotillas, all of them have been repelled since the Operation Cast Lead Israeli invasion and attack upon the Gaza Strip in December of 2008 to January of 2009. All attempted sailings into Gaza port have been scuttled by Israel since then. The two vessels that sailed in August of 2008, the same year that Operation Cast Lead took place, a few months after our voyage, those two vessels did successfully enter the port of Gaza City and some five or six subsequent sailings before Cast Lead did succeed in reaching Gaza City. Ever since the war, which was quite obviously a politically motivated war, which happened only weeks before the Israeli national elections to keep Netanyahu and his party in power, his party coalition in power, all attempted sailing since that war, the first of the three major attacks by Israel, massacres committed by Israel on the Gaza Strip in recent years, all sailing since them have been scuttled by Israeli naval commandos. Their crews and the passengers aboard those vessels, many of them roughed up, beaten, some severely, all taken into Israeli custody, even though every single one of those attacks happened not in Israeli territorial waters, not even in Gaza territorial waters, but in international waters. And for no good reason, because Israel knows that these vessels are manned by humanitarian workers. And I should say human rights workers. There's an important distinction that can be made between humanitarian activity and human rights activity. And those people on board the ships, the flotillas, etc., were taken into Israeli custody, held some for several months, and eventually all either deported to their countries of origins or to where they lived in either the Palestine territories or into Israel, or maybe even that they were prevented from coming back into Israel. At any rate, of course, they mentioned this is the way they word this on this article. In 2010, 2 years after the first successful voyages, in May of 2010, Israeli occupation commandos staged a botched raid on a six-ship flotilla in international waters, killing 10 Turkish nationals and sparking a diplomatic crisis with Ankara, which is the capital of Turkey, that has yet to be resolved. The vessel where the murders of the passengers aboard the ship by Israeli commandos flew a Turkish flag. It was registered as a Turkish registered vessels, so the diplomatic crisis with Ankara, Turkey's capital, that's where that comes from. There has been one comment to this article, an important correction, from Too Big to Learn, January 26. It wasn't a, quote, botched raid. It was a carefully executed act of state terrorist piracy, killing 10 and injuring 60. And covered up to a large extent through wholesale theft of all recording devices by the hundreds of peaceful human rights activists aboard the ships, among the flotilla of six ships. and again, this happened in international waters. It was helmeted, body armored, flak jacketed naval commandos with submachine guns, as it were, who executed some in the back and some in the back of the head. The 10 who were killed outright. One of them actually was sent into a coma from which he never recovered, and he died 4 years later on the very day of the fourth anniversary of the raid, bringing the death toll from 9 to 10. One of those original 9 who were killed, by the way, was Turkish American, one of his parents being of American heritage. And as this writer indicates, some there were 10 killed and 60 who were also either shot or beaten, somehow injured in that attack amongst the small fleet or flotilla. And he brings up something that is just as important as mentioning as the casualty list here. The incident was covered up to a large extent through the wholesale theft of all recording devices that were held by the crew and passengers of the flotillas. Israel, and this, of course, is not an isolated incident in the history of Israeli military actions, even when they're quote-unquote fighting nonviolent protesters. Or even if some of them happen to be violent and choose to throw rocks at the Israelis, the presence of Israeli so-called defense forces in the West Bank, which is occupied Palestine territory, and originally in Gaza, had a nasty habit of absconding, grabbing and absconding with, taking off with video cameras, recordings, audio recordings of events, and they do that all the time. And then they manage to get away with telling, certainly people in the United States, that somehow Israelis in Israel are threatened by the actions of protests and various nonviolent activities and projects in the West Bank, even when these Palestinian Arabs are simply trying to preserve their villages, the places that they've lived in for many generations, if not hundreds or thousands of years, on land, on their own land. And Israel has this history of either grabbing and taking possession of the Palestinian people's recording devices, thereby denying visual and audio evidence to the world of what happened, but keeping them and convincing Americans and the U.S. government that somehow these are all actions that were perpetrated by the Palestinians on the Israeli army. Yeah, like the Palestinians all have AK-47s or M-16s or whatever variations of those rifles, assault rifles, that the Israeli army carry with them at all times. It's so silly. I mean, Israel is in their soldiers are in BBDs, full battle dress, fighting, quote unquote, generally unarmed or minimally armed, very rarely armed with any kind of firearms or explosives. People in their own villages on their own land, where Israel is not even supposed to be according to international law. And so this, again, the wholesale theft of all recording devices by the Israeli Navy is not an isolated incident. This goes on all the time. Okay, I feel like I'm beginning to meander here. And that's what that is about. It's 3:38 in the afternoon. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. And streaming live at freakradio.org. I got a request from We the People, Your Voice in Our Government. Now, I'm a little confused by this because the email address given here is admin@whitehouse.gov, but I'm not all sure that this is a document sanctioned by the president, but it is a petition, and I just, you know, I'm not necessarily pushing the petition, but take that as you will. It says here, yeah, petitions whitehouse.gov, someone in the White House, in the West Wing or whatever, is pushing this. Thank you for submitting your signature to the We the People petition. File sedition charges against Speaker John Boehner for inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to address Congress regarding Iran via the whitehouse.gov. By confirming your signature below, obviously I already signed this and clicked on it, you are participating in the White House's We the People online petitions platform, and you agree to abide by the We the People terms, participation, etc., etc. Here, let's, just in the way of describing what this is about. Petition title, as I said, file sedition charges, a demand for Congress or someone to file sedition charges against Speaker John Boehner for inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to address Congress regarding Iran. Congress circumvented the president in their quite inappropriate, professional political quarters, this is agreed to be an inappropriate action as Israeli national elections are upcoming, and it is a policy of both the White House and at least some members of Congress not to treat with the leaders of foreign countries shortly before that foreign country's national elections so as to avoid tainting the integrity of those elections. Here's the description. Speaker of the House, John Boehner, committed sedition against the people of the United States. This is the text of the, obviously, of the petition. John Boehner has committed sedition against the people of the United States of America and the President of the United States of America by undermining the President's authority regarding executive action on Iran and breaching executive protocol by inviting Benjamin Netanyahu to address both houses of Congress regarding nuclear arms talks, as well as the implementation of sanctions between the United States and the country of Iran. To breach White House protocol in this instance is a tactic by Congress to retaliate against the President of the U.S. and to overthrow executive authority, thereby directly placing the people of the United States of America in peril with threat of nuclear war, as well as damaging relations between Israel, Iran, and the United States of America. Well, that's quite the charge that what Congress and what Speaker Boehner is doing with this invitation to the Prime Minister of Israel, as it says here, directly placing the people of the U.S. of A. in peril with the threat of nuclear war. Well, they can certainly say that by virtue of the fact that the United States has many, many nukes. Israel, certainly relative to its size, has many, many nukes, roughly somewhere between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons. And who really knows what Iran has at this point? So it's safe to at least mention the fact that there are nuclear weapons involved. Well, speaking of John Boehner and this whole business, I'm now going to read to you, as I did a week ago, I believe, a week or two ago, Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and chair of Mideast Studies, University of San Francisco. This man happens to be an occasional contributor, probably having to do with the Sentinel's editorial board's occasionally granted permission for a Boehner article to be printed in said paper. So he does contribute to the Santa Cruz Sentinel. This is entitled Netanyahu's Speech and the Democrats' Dangerous Embrace of Extremism. Actually, what has happened here, if I can get to the beginning of this other page. I know where it is. Okay. Let me just... You see, Stefan Zunes explained that he wrote this article 3 years ago when the Democrat... when the U.S. Senate was still controlled by the Democratic Party and the House was under Republican control. And he wanted to share this article again with us, dear reader and listener. So this article is actually written June 6, 2011, 3.5 years ago. June 6th. And updated August 6, 2011. Let's look at this 3.5-year-old article and decide if it still pertains today. As Israeli opposition parties, peace and human rights activists, and editorialists denounce their prime minister's intransigence in the face of President Barack Obama's peace initiative. Remember now, folks, this is from three and a half years ago. As Israeli opposition parties, peace and human rights activists, and editorialists denounce their prime minister's intransigence in the face of President Barack Obama's peace initiative, congressional Democrats here in the United States have instead joined their Republican counterparts in lining up to support the right-wing Israeli leader's defiance. As Benjamin Netanyahu arrogantly rejected Obama's modest parameters for a peace settlement in a May 20, 2011 speech before a joint session of Congress, a rare honor for a foreign leader, Democrats joined Republicans in giving him no less than 29 standing ovations, more than were given to Obama during his State of the Union speech earlier this year, again in the year 2011. Mitchell Plitnick of Jewish Voice for Peace, in the immediate aftermath of Netanyahu's speech, observed how, and I quote, "The United States itself has never been as shameless in its blind support," end quote, for the Israeli right, the right wing, placing support for the Likud leader. Likud is Netanyahu's political party in Israel there. Placing support for the Likud leader, quote, over the interests of justice and human rights and even its own self-interests, end quote. In an apparent challenge to her president, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, told Netanyahu in response to his harsh retort to Obama, Pelosi said, "I think it's clear that both sides of the Capitol believe you advance the cause of peace." Her harsh retort to Obama, talking to Netanyahu. Similarly, Senate Majority Leader at the time, Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, rebuked President Obama by stating, "No one should set premature parameters about borders, about building, or about anything else," end quote. And that term for peace talks, quote, "will not be set through speeches." As former President Jimmy Carter observed in an op-ed in the New York Times, in embracing Netanyahu's position, the current Democratic leadership is not only rejecting the current U.S. president, but previous agreements involving the Israelis and longstanding positions taken by the United States and previous administrations. Ironically, Palestinians and most other international observers believed Obama did not go nearly far enough in challenging Netanyahu's colonization and annexation of occupied Palestinian territories. He did not call for a full Israeli withdrawal from the Palestinian West Bank, which the Israelis invaded in June 1967 war, and which is legally recognized as non-self-governing territories under belligerent occupation, only that the pre-1967 borders be the starting point of negotiations. Obama assumes Israel should be allowed to annex parts of the West Bank with large concentrations of Israeli settlers who moved into the occupied territory in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, a series of UN Security Council resolutions, and a landmark decision by the International Court of Justice. And then parenthetically, in return for allowing Israel to annex these illegal settlements, Obama called on Israel to swap Israeli land, something that Netanyahu has rejected. In addition, while Jewish West Jerusalem, remaining part of Israel, was a given, Obama insisted that Arab East Jerusalem, the largest Palestinian city and center of Palestine's cultural, religious, commercial, and educational institutions, was subjected to negotiations. Obama defended Israel's right to, quote, self-defense, end quote, as ever, but insisted, I threw the as ever into that, but insisted that Palestinian, but insisted the Palestinian state be demilitarized. Indeed, he rejected Palestinian independence except under conditions acceptable to it. Their Israeli occupiers. He even questioned whether Israel should negotiate with the Fatah-led Palestine Authority if it included Hamas in its ruling coalition, because the Islamist group refused to recognize Israel's right to exist, even as it insisted the Palestinians negotiate with the Israeli government, despite the fact that some parties in Netanyahu's ruling coalition refused to recognize Palestine's right to exist. To an overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress, however, Obama was simply not anti-Palestinian enough. Implications. As the noted political scientist and American interest editor Walter Russell Mead observed, Netanyahu's deadly, devastating speech to Congress, in which he eviscerated President Obama's foreign policy to prolonged and repeated standing ovations by members of both parties, may have been the single most stunning and effective public rebuke to an American president a foreign leader has ever delivered, demonstrating to the whole world that the Prime Minister of Israel has substantially more support in both the House and the Senate than the President of the United States does. End quote. A reminder now, I'm reading from an article by USF Professor of Politics, Stephen Zunes, written in the middle of 2011, regarding Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Washington, D.C. back then, 3.5 years ago. Continuing now. Ironically, most Israelis think otherwise. Polls show that 57% of Israelis supported Obama's speech and are critical of the hardline anti-peace line of Netanyahu that Pelosi, Reid, and other congressional leaders find so appealing. The Israeli peace group Gush Shalom issued a statement saying, "The speech of Prime Minister Netanyahu in the U.S. Congress was composed of dozens of colorful gimmicks and empty cliches. Talk of a peace which he does not intend to conclude, and of a fictional Palestinian state which has no intention of seeing, of which he, Netanyahu, has no intention of seeing become reality." End quote. I'm going to read that again. The Israeli peace group Gush Shalom issued a statement saying, quote, The speech of PM Netanyahu in the U.S. Congress was composed of dozens of colorful gimmicks and empty cliches, talk of a peace which he, Netanyahu, does not intend to conclude, and of a fictional Palestinian state which he, Netanyahu, has no intention of seeing become reality. Adding, quote, the extremist position that Netanyahu presented constitutes a final closing of the door to renewed negotiations and an embarkation on a course of collision with the Palestinians and the entire world, end quote. Leading Israeli commentator Akiva Eldar observed in Haaretz that the strength of the applause bears no relation to the genuine interests of the State of Israel. Referring, of course, to the applause of American lawmakers on Capitol Hill. And Gideon Levy, writing in the same Israeli newspaper and documenting the numerous, quote, lies and delusions in Netanyahu's speech, observed, did Americans' elected representatives know that they were cheering for the death of possibility? If America loved it, we're in big trouble. We, referring to Gideon Levy and his fellow Israelis. Continuing here, Deborah DeLee, president of the liberal Zionist group Americans for Peace Now, observed that Netanyahu's speech represents a step backward, away from the peace that Israelis and Palestinians yearn for and deserve. And that, quote, rather than laying out his promised new vision of peace, Netanyahu stayed mainly on the well-worn path of grandstanding, blame-laying, and fear-mongering. DeLee added that the rightist prime minister's preconditions for negotiations were unrealistic and are an, quote, anathema to reviving negotiations and to achieving real peace and security for Israel, end quote. Similarly, Harvard political scientist Steve Walt observed how these members of Congress, quote, aren't genuine friends of Israel because every burst of applause was another nail in the coffin of the Zionist dream. As a result, to claim that Congress is, quote, too pro-Israel is simply inaccurate. As Obama himself has observed, the current Israeli policy, so enthusiastically embraced by Congress, is unsustainable and contrary to Israel's genuine security interests. Support for Netanyahu, then, is not support for Israel. It is support for an extreme and dangerous kind of militarism. As James Follows of The Atlantic put it so accurately, Netanyahu is the Dick Cheney of Israel, characterizing the former vice president as someone who, and I quote, mistook short-term intransigence for long-term strategic wisdom, seemed blind and tone-deaf to the moral and soft power components of influence, profited from a polarized and fearful political climate, and attempted to command rather than earn support from allies and potential adversaries, end quote. In giving Netanyahu more standing ovations than their own president, congressional Democrats have joined Republicans in effectively endorsing a Dick Cheney approach to the Middle East. Not only is it harmful for Israel, but it is also harmful to U.S. interests. Even the staunchly pro-Israel pundit Andrew Sullivan noted how Netanyahu's view, shared by Congress, is essentially one in which, and I quote here, from Sullivan, the U.S. is supposed to sacrifice its broader goals of reconciliation with an emergent democratic Arab world, potentially jeopardize its relations with a democratic Egypt, isolate itself from every other ally, and identify the U.S. permanently with a state that, in its current configuration and with its current behavior, deepens and inflames the global conflict with jihadist Islam, end quote. Yet both Republicans and Democrats are so blinded by their militarist ideology that they are not only willing to sacrifice the interests of Palestinians, the most immediate victims of Netanyahu's policies, but Israel and the United States as well. As will be examined below, The overwhelmingly positive reaction to Netanyahu's speech by congressional Democrats raises serious questions about whether those who oppose a Cheney-style foreign policy should continue to support the Democratic Party. First, though, it bears examination as to what specifically House and Senate Democrats were joining their Republican counterparts in cheering about. What Congress supported. The significance of the bipartisan here, before I begin this, let me point out that it's a minute before 4 o'clock p.m. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with Ren Tawil on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we are streaming 24/7, and in this case, live, streaming at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the free streaming link, or otherwise follow instructions on our website for how to engage in our streaming web. And if you do go to, if you visit our page at freakradio.org, you will see a number of links to a bunch of exciting and interesting features, like contact information of Free Radio Santa Cruz, how you can donate, how you can submit written comments, suggestions, criticisms, etc., how you too can become a programmer with Free Radio, including a link to download an application that you can send in through snail mail, and interesting stuff like that. Okay, continuing with the Stefan Zunes article, which is entitled, three-and-a-half-year-old article, Netanyahu's Speech and the Democrats' Dangerous Embrace of Extremism. I'm right here, folks. Still plugging away. Giving my throat a rest and some therapy there. Okay. Now, what Congress supported. The significance of the bipartisan rebuke of Obama and the broad consensus of the international community is evident in the specific line spoken by Netanyahu that received the most enthusiastic applause. Netanyahu got his biggest ovations when he defied Obama's suggestion that the 1967 borders be the basis of negotiations and reiterated his pledge to never end the Israeli occupation of Arab East Jerusalem. A whole series of UN Security Council resolutions underscores that Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem is illegal and should be considered null and void. A decision reiterated in a near-unanimous decision of the International Supreme International Court of Justice. Similarly, UN Security Council Resolution 242, long considered the basis for peace by both Democratic and Republican administrations, reiterates the long-standing international legal principle regarding, quote, the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, end quote. This was irrelevant to the U.S. Congress, the vast majority of whom gave Netanyahu a particularly raucous standing ovation when he denied Israeli forces and settlers on the West Bank were foreign occupiers. This was cheered by members of the U.S. Congress. Continuing, they cheered when he specifically insisted that Israeli occupation forces should remain as far east as the Jordan Valley. They cheered further when he justified his insistence that the West Bank was Jewish land because it was, and I quote, the land of our forefathers, to which Abraham brought the idea of one God and where David set out to confront Goliath, end quote. That both Democrats and Republicans would give a standing ovation to an assertion that particular scriptural passages trump international law is indicative of just how much influence right-wing fundamentalists now have over both political parties. Netanyahu also received a standing ovation when he defended his plans for illegally annexing conquered Palestinian territory by claiming the 1967 borders were, quote-unquote, indefensible. Apparently, the overwhelming majority of Congress was ignorant of the fact that Israel defended those borders quite successfully in two wars, that the military balance between Israel and its neighbors is far more favorable for Israel than it was back then, and that Obama explicitly insisted that any new Palestinian state be demilitarized. Furthermore, the 1967 borders are far more defensible than the scattered settlements and military outposts in the West Bank that Netanyahu, with congressional support, insists on illegally incorporating into Israel. I repeat, the 1967 borders are far more defensible than the scattered Jewish settlements and military outposts in the West Bank that Netanyahu, with U.S. congressional support, insists on illegally incorporating into Israel. The bipartisan audience cheered further when Netanyahu denounced any role for the UN in determining a settlement, insisting that Israel alone, quote, will be very firm on where we put the border, end quote. In short, Congress believes that the fate of Palestine should not rest on the Palestinians, on international law or the United States, but on the occupying power alone. And let me just take a good close look at something here. Okay, that's nice. Let's continue now. But on the occupying power alone, there was also raucous applause when Netanyahu added new conditions to peace with the Palestinians, specifically that they, the Palestinians, explicitly recognize Israel as a, quote, Jewish state, a precondition that was not demanded of Jordan or Egypt in their peace treaties with Israel. Indeed, virtually no international agreement has ever required one party to explicitly endorse the ideological identity of a state, only the legitimacy of its government, which the Palestinians have already done. And in parentheses here, as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas put it, it is not my job to give a description of the state. Former Palestine Liberation Organization PLO leader Yasser Arafat unilaterally recognized Israel in 1988, the same year, by the way, when Israeli commandos bombed that boat before it even entered Israeli territorial waters, due to carry Palestinians back to Haifa. Yasser Arafat unilaterally recognized Israel in 88, which was codified by the PLO in the 1993 Oslo Accords, which shortly thereafter removed references from its charter delegitimizing Israel. As Abbas recently reiterated, our position is that we recognize Israel. We fully believe in the two-state solution. A Palestinian state on the 1967 borders, based on the 1967 borders, and the state of Israel, living next to each other in peace and security. Yet Netanyahu received perhaps the most extended applause of his speech when he insisted that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, quote, has never been about the establishment of a Palestinian state. It has always been about the existence of the Jewish state. No kidding. That is an important fundamental truth that should be never forgotten. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has never been about the establishment of a Palestinian state. It's always been about the existence of the Jewish state, and that goes back to the November 1947 partition plan implemented by the United Nations over the wishes of the native Palestinian people. And even then, it wasn't that Jews living in Palestine at the time were excited about there being a secure and defensible Jewish state area and a secure and defensible Arab state area, their interest was in building a bridgehead in Palestine for the new Israelis to establish their state and, as has been borne out in history, to take over the rest of historic Palestine. So for them, it really has never been about the existence of two states. It's been about the existence of a single, preferably exclusively Jewish state. Okay, no, I added all that stuff. Let's continue with the article. We're almost to the end. Honest, really. Well, just, I don't know, 3/5 of the way, 5/7 of the way through it. Let's continue. One of the most telling examples of the mindset of the bipartisan supermajority came an Israeli-American peace activist, Ray Abeli, sitting in the visitor's gallery, began shouting, "Equal rights of Palestinians." Right-wing supporters of the Israeli prime minister began attacking her until Capitol Police rescued her and took her to a hospital where her injuries were determined to be serious enough to require an overnight stay. This happened in the gallery, the House of Representatives gallery there, in the U.S. Capitol. I mean, one can argue that it was inappropriate and disruptive for anyone to begin shouting anything, let alone equal rights of Palestinians. But right-wing supporters, according to Zunis's article here, supporters of the Israeli prime minister began attacking her, physically attacking her. And it took Capitol Police to intervene and rescue her from attack which may very well have killed her. Her or him. Her. Ray Abelea. One of the most telling examples of the mindset of the bipartisan supermajority. Okay, let's continue reading and listening. After initially booing her for interrupting the speaker, not to mention attacking her, assaulting her, virtually the entire House floor rose to its feet cheering while she was being manhandled and silenced. God, I'm going to read that again. After initially booing her for interrupting the speaker, virtually the entire House floor rose to its feet, cheering while she was being manhandled in silence. It says here, videos show those who could see that section of the gallery were looking directly at the attack, clapping and cheering, apparently well aware of what was happening, indicating how Congress believes such dissident voices should be treated. Okay, final subheading here. U.S. liberals keep supporting the Israeli right, says Stefan Zunis here. As indicative in the reaction of congressional Democrats to Netanyahu's speech, it is becoming increasingly obvious that one cannot profess to support human rights and international law, much less Middle East peace, and support the Democratic Party as well. In comparison to other political parties and industrialized democracies on these core issues, the Democrats are well to the right of not only socialist and liberal parties, but almost all of the conservative parties as well, the American conservative parties. Indeed, the only Western political parties that are as right-wing as the Democratic Party regarding these principles and their application in the Middle East are the U.S. Republicans and Europe's small, far-right, xenophobic, anti-Muslim parties. In short, the Democratic Party represents a right-wing fringe. It is important to note that there are a couple of dozen progressive Democratic House members who were not cheering Netanyahu, who do care about human rights and international law, who are aligned with Israeli progressives and moderates, and who deserve support. They are a small minority of the nearly 250 Democrats in Congress, however, and are not represented in the party leadership. That figure of 250 Democrats, of course, being a 3.5-year-old statistic. It is easy to try to blame right-wing pro-Likud groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, but this would be misleading. The vast majority of pre-Likud Democrats are in safe political districts, and there would be little political consequence of rejecting Netanyahu's extremism and instead supporting Israeli moderates. Parenthetically, for example, every Democrat who refused to support a 2006 resolution defending Israel's devastating war on Lebanon was reelected by a larger margin in November than they had been 2 years earlier. Reelected by a larger margin that November than they had been 2 years earlier. Similarly, the overwhelming majority of American Jews are far closer to Obama's position than that of Netanyahu in Congress. The problem is that most congressional Democrats appear to sincerely embrace this right-wing militaristic worldview and know they can get away with it because, quote, progressive organizations and political action committees, PACs, will support them anyway. This contrasts with the 1980s, when their counterparts with comparable positions in Central America were disparaged as, quote, death squad Democrats and denied such support. Things are different today, however. For example, Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat of California, who takes perhaps the most pro-Likud position of any Democratic senator and was among the first on her feet cheering Netanyahu, was named Progressive Hero of 2010 by the liberal group Democracy for America. One can imagine a senator in the 1980s cheering Roberto d'Aubuisson or a similar right-wing U.S. Central American ally and still getting such recognition? Move On, which is one of the largest political action committees of any group supporting Democratic candidates, has also endorsed and raised money for House and Senate members who cheered the rightist Israeli leader and have endorsed his policies, and has also falsely labeled them as progressive. Congressional Democrats get away with such supporting right-wing governments like Israel because groups like Move On and Democracy for America keep misleading progressive voters into thinking that people who support Netanyahu are progressives as well. And because people who profess to care about peace and human rights keep supporting these groups and their candidates. This is not to say that one should never vote for a right-wing Democrat to prevent an even further right-wing Republican from being elected. However, falsely claiming they are progressive when they support a Cheney-style foreign policy and making them think there are no political consequences for that support makes it virtually impossible to replace them with people who do care about human rights and international law and to force them to move away from their right-wing positions. Let's wrap this up here now. There will always be Democrats who will sell out to corporate interests and compromise. However, when it comes to such blatant affronts to international legal norms as those exemplified by Netanyahu's May 20th speech, May 20, 2011, it is time to draw the line. It is time to make it clear to congressional Democrats that if they continue to oppose international law and human rights by supporting Netanyahu, they will lose the support of voters who do. It's time to make clear to Move On, Democracy for America, and other groups who endorse such candidates that they will not receive money or other support until they make human rights and international law criteria for endorsement. If enough people do that, If enough people do that, AIPAC will no longer be a factor, and right-wing foreign leaders like Netanyahu will no longer get standing ovations from Democrats. End of article. You may follow Stefan Zunes on Twitter, www.twitter.com/#szunes. That Zunes is spelled Z as in Z, U-N-E-S. Twitter.com/#szunes. S-Z-U-N-E-S. Here's the phone numbers again. If you want to talk at me, area code 831 for both lines 1 and 2. Line 1 is 427-3772. 427-3772. Line 2 is the following, 469-3119. Again, line 2, 469-3119. And I remind you, even if you do not specifically want to comment on any of this material I present on the Mideast Migraine Show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, let me know what direction you would like this show to go. Do you want it to go nowhere? I challenge you to call one of those two numbers I just gave and tell me to my ear. If you want me to go, call and tell me to my ear. That's what it's taken, folks, to get people to call in. You know, it's fairly easy and admittedly rather tempting for me to assume that the reason why people don't call is because they happen to agree totally with everything that they hear and so have nothing to challenge, have nothing to argue about. I would like to think that people are kind of suffering from an enforced shyness, in that they cannot argue or do not have the background education and intellectual capacity, as it were, to have a fruitful discussion. Then again, it's not, if that were true, it doesn't say much for the listenership of free radio now, would it? I wish you people would call in so you can prove me wrong on any of those counts. Advanced intellectual capacity notwithstanding. I'm insulting some of you, depending on your frame of mind. Are you listening? All in good spirit, though, and all towards a progressive, enlightened America. Oh, yes, and the entire world, ultimately, right? Now I'm sounding downright fascist. Well, you need to call in and call me a fascist. Don't let me get away with saying it. No, I take that back. I am not a fascist. I'm getting creative and edgy to spark some of you into action. There we go. That's more like it. Which line is this here? Hi, you're on free radio.
Hi, I'm just calling because you're desperate. I do listen to your show, and thank you very much.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. I really do appreciate hearing that. I hope you're getting something out of it.
Yes. Yes, it is helping. Thank you very much.
Do you want to give us your first name? Or
Charles. Charles in Monterey.
Thank you, Charles in Monterey. It's good to know that a person as far away as Monterey is hearing, and please keep listening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. Thank you, Charles in Monterey. That is indeed... Off you go. That is indeed encouraging. And I really do sincerely hope that, regardless of the degree of edginess, if not outright blasphemous, the things coming out of my mouth are, that it really does encourage people to take stock in their own degree of interest in this subject matter, and appreciate the fact that I'm a mover here. I'm trying to get people to think along the lines that, well, among many other things, Palestinians are far more than a bunch of Islamic militants. They are far more than terrorists and refugees. You know, there was a time, and this harkens back to long before most Americans had ever even heard the word Muslim or Islam, back in the days when the general message that came across Western media news outlets, the message about who the Palestinian Arabs were, the general gist of what we heard on the TV and radio waves and in print, was that Palestinians like to hijack planes and kill a lot of innocent people. Of course, the Israelis killing the thousands and thousands of innocent Palestinian Arabs and other Arabs over the decades was rarely, if ever, spoken of. And often not even in times of actual war, but in the course of maintaining their occupation of territories that are being held by Israel's military illegally, defending themselves from Fedayeen and other various infiltration freedom fighters, if you want to call them terrorists, go right ahead. You've been calling them nothing but terrorists all these years anyway, but they certainly are freedom fighters by their own recognition. And this happening on Israel's border with Egypt, Jordan, certainly Lebanon and Syria. Israel is indeed surrounded by many enemies on all sides. I'm not going to say that is not true. What it comes down to is, what can Israel actually do? Preferably not under the tutelage of this most right-wing Israeli government ever in its 67, almost 67-year-long history. What can Israel do to make these enemies, not necessarily the leading governments of these surrounding Arab nations, but enemies within who happen to reside currently in those countries, what can Israel do to do away with that threat? Look at all the actions, the things that Israel does to create its own enemies, to make its own people insecure, to the point where the only practical thing that they think they can do to make themselves immune to suicide bombing attacks, etc., is to build iron walls and electrified fences. And yes, portions, several hundred miles worth of the electrified portions of the apartheid wall separating Israel from land that Israel happens to control anyway, are electrified. Build the wall. First, they built one separating northern Gaza and perhaps the rest of Gaza from Israel. And then build one the entire length of the rest of the boundary between Israel and the West Bank, purposely including all those illegal settlements that are adjacent to Israel, which utterly decimates the life of the Palestinians living in those areas, since the wall interrupts the continuity of their land, cuts in some cases not only between villages, but right through the middle of individual properties of Palestinian Arabs, making it impossible for, say, farmers to plow their fields if the farmhouse is separated from their lands, that kind of thing. So, yes. Yes, indeedy. While Israel has made itself almost impenetrably secure from such attacks, and realistically, they can never make themselves entirely secure from those attacks. But even though the suicide bombings have gone down to almost nothing, and attacks by Palestinians have devolved from cross-border attacks to a few frustrated, maddened Palestinian Arabs in Israel who go crazy and start running around with a knife and assaulting people willy-nilly. They still have to put up with those problems. What can they do? What can the Israelis do to eliminate that problem? Just toss it off and say, well, nobody's perfect. Israeli society is always going to have this chasm between Jewish people and non-Jewish people. The Israelis have made themselves almost impervious to suicide attacks and cross-border attacks, while they, the Israelis, have continued to kill more and more and more Palestinian Arabs. So what is a security wall to Israel is indeed not only an apartheid wall for the Palestinians, it is a death wall for the Palestinians. Allowing Israel and those illegal Jewish settlements, exclusively Jewish settlements, to take more and more precedence in land that Israel undoubtedly, undeniably covets, wanting to fully incorporate it into the Jewish state of Israel. Through those settlements, and by expanding those Jewish settlements, and in the course of that expansion and quote-unquote defending the Jews in those settlements from the Palestinian Arabs who were there before they were, life has gotten rougher and more dire and far more dangerous for Palestinian Americans. This, after all the attempted movements toward peace, various peace processes, whether you spell peace P-E-A-C-E or P-I-E-C-E, peace processes, look what it has led to. Things are only getting nothing but worse for the Palestinians. No one in any true position of power, in any effective position of power, are helping the Palestinians or contributing to the creation of a free and independent and secure Palestinian state. Do I have to say it in so many words? Israel does not want any kind of a Palestinian state. They covet all of it. They call it Eretz Israel in Hebrew, the land of Israel, talking about all of historic Palestine and completely refuting any sense of Palestinian nationality. All right. Let's have a musical break here. Phone lines 831-427-3772 and 469-3119.
إيدي بإيدك تتطلع بتطلع بعيونك بحبك كمان كل ما بشوفك حبيبي بحس بأمان كل ما بتطلع بعيونك بحبك كمان ربي عمري يا نسمة حنان شمس بشتا وزهر ميسان ليل نهار أنا بحلم فيك رقاني بأجمل
Track 9 from the Putumayo Arabic Beat album. The artist Zain al-Jundi. Ajmal Haram. Another Assyrian-inspired number. I tend to assume that Zain al-Jundi is Assyrian. Clearly this music is something of a fusion of more traditional sounds and rhythms with perhaps Western melodies, the enhancement of Western electronic enhancements, and modern styling. But there's still some other compilations of more traditional recordings going back many decades in some cases. I have one album, excellent album of Arab American music, the retrospective collection that I play from time to time. You're just going to have to keep listening to Mideast Migraine Show for the next time I play that album. And to be fair, if you want to listen to recorded episodes of earlier Mideast Madnesses and its previously named Mideast Migraines program, the older name for this show, which I've been doing for well over 2.5 years now. If you want to listen to the older shows, go to my archives. You won't have any luck if you find yourself onto archives on our website, freakradio.org, because I don't put them there. I've never put them there because there's something complicated and inconsistent, if not downright defunct at this point in time, about Free Radio's archive. So what I do is I go to another website, radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, the digital character 4, as in 1, 2, 3, 4, radioforall.net, radioforall.net. Just plug in Mideast Migraines in the search box, and you'll find my shows in chronological order, most recent at the top. You can also go to Santa Cruz in Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, the Santa Cruz Media Center Indie Bay website, where I also file recordings of my shows. They're a little more difficult to nail down and find, but you can do it, at least going back to a certain point in time. So that's how you get to the archives of this show. And, by the way, some of the other recorded episodes of other Free Radio Santa Cruz programs that are produced in our studio here, or in some cases produced out on the street by our more intrepid adventurers such as Robert Norse and his Bathrobes Pierre, what does he call it? Thursday, let's see. Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. Whether you're talking about his program at 6 in the evening on Thursdays or Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides on Sunday morning, started at 9:30 a.m. He does a lot of street interviews with homeless people and other disenfranchised members of society who have their stories to tell and dealing with the authorities, etc., etc. It's 4:38. I guess I better get on the shtick here. I got to be off the air in about 15 minutes. Let's see. Commemoration of the 70th anniversary during a memorial service. I want to talk about genocide. This is from the United Nations' own news outlet, UN News Center. And I know I read a lot of these, and a lot, admittedly, the content of a lot of these UN News Center dispatches is rather stale and pie in the sky, as I like to call it. And just a lot of formal, self-congratulatory talk, frankly, about what they're doing at the UN and what people are doing at the UN. But this, we're getting into, well, let me just read you the title of this. The United Nations, the UN has, quote, a duty to speak out against anti-Semitism, Ban Ki-moon tells the General Assembly. And I will identify these people as I get into the article. This is dated 22 January of this year, 2015. UN has duty to speak out against anti-Semitism, Ban Ki-moon tells the General Assembly of the UN. During an informal meeting of the General Assembly this morning to address concerns of a rise in anti-Semitic violence worldwide, top United Nations officials echoed the view of keynote speaker Bernard Henri Lévy, who lamented the, quote, renewed advance of this radical inhumanity. Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, addressed the meeting via video message expressing solidarity in the worldwide fight against anti-Semitism and noting that Jews have experienced, quote, insidious bias and, quote, overt violence throughout the course of history. The systematic murder of millions of European Jews in the Holocaust showed anti-Semitism at its most monstrous, said Ban Ki-moon. He continued, a United Nations that wants to be true to its founding aims and ideals has a duty to speak out against anti-Semitism. Noting that extremism is on the rise worldwide, he said responses to it had to avoid perpetuating cycles of demonization and playing into the hands of those who seek to divide. One particular trap related to the Middle East conflict. It's a funny single sentence. I got it grammatically incorrect, but one particular trap related to the Middle East conflict. You could just probably just punctuation there. A period where it should have been a comma. Continuing. Ban continued to say, grievances about Israeli actions must never be used as an excuse to attack Jews. In the same vein, criticisms of Israeli actions should not be summarily dismissed as anti-Semitism. End quote. I'm going to read that short paragraph again. Listen to every word. Listen to both sentences carefully. Ban Ki-moon said the following, grievances about Israeli actions, the nation of Israel's actions, must never be used as an excuse to attack Jews. In the same vein, criticisms of the state of Israel, should not be summarily dismissed as anti-Semitism. End quote. Roughly. Alvaro Mendoza Mora, acting president of the General Assembly, looked ahead to the International Day of Commemoration of the Victims of the Holocaust next week, underlining not only the need to remember the tragedies, but to learn from the, quote, unspeakable atrocities that were committed. The international community also had an obligation to prevent acts of intolerance and hate from happening again. Anti-Semitism and other forms of intolerance and prejudice were on the rise despite the prohibition of religious and racial discrimination enshrined in many of the international community's most important fundamental documents, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is a UN document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Quote, as we witness the shadow of intolerance permeating so many segments of public and private life, It is of utmost importance that all stakeholders be actively involved in our efforts to fight against prejudice, while also promoting and strengthening tolerance, mutual understanding, dialogue, and respect. End quote. That from Mr. Mendonca E. Mora, acting president of the GA at the UN. Continuing, many tools were available to do so, he said, underlining the importance of education and pointing out that he would convene a high-level thematic debate on April 6th on promoting tolerance and reconciliation. Keynote speaker Bernard-Henri Lévy said the General Assembly was given the, quote, sacred task, end quote, of preventing the spirits of anti-Semitism from awakening. They had awoken, though, he said, and that was why this meeting was taking place. He sought to refute modern analysis of anti-Semitism, including the idea that it was just a variety of racism, saying that looking the evil, quote, squarely in the face, required better understanding and the abandonment of old cliches about anti-Semitism and how it operates. Today, he said, anti-Semitism stemmed from an anti-Zionist delirium, quote, unquote, anti-Zionist. Let me start again. Today, he said, this is just so I can pay attention to what I'm reading. Today, Bernard-Henri Lévy, said that anti-Semitism stemmed from an, quote, anti-Zionist delirium in those opposing the reestablishment of Jews in their historic homeland from Holocaust denial and from the perceived use by Jews of the memory of their suffering to, quote, unquote, overshadow other martyrs. Anti-Semitism needs those three formulations which are like the three vital components of a moral atomic bomb, Mr. Lévy said. And he continued, each alone would be enough to discredit a people, but when the three are combined, we can be pretty sure of facing an explosion which all Jews everywhere in the world will be the designated targets, end quote. Very colorful picture here of a wide view of the special event on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the German Nazi extermination camp in Auschwitz-Birkenau, Poland. And with a larger caption of the picture saying, genocide occurs when warning signs are ignored and action is not taken. That said by the UN deputy chief. Let's continue with the text of this dispatch. That is the end of the first article. I smacked both of these on the same page here. And I'll start the second one. It sounds like a repetition of the first, but it's not the same word for word. That was the one I just read to you is dated January 22. This the day before. During a commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi death camp today, United Nations Deputy Secretary General John Eliasson called for reflection on how better to prevent horrific crimes witnessed during the Holocaust and other genocides. He said, Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson said, it is important that we examine why we continue to fail to prevent mass atrocities, despite lessons learned, despite knowledge of causes and drivers, and despite our assurances of, quote unquote, never again. Genocide can only happen when we ignore the warning signs and are unwilling to take action. The event held at UN headquarters in New York and organized by the permanent mission of Poland to the UN and shared by Bogusław Winid preceded the annual International Day of Commemoration of the Victims of the Holocaust. The permanent representatives to the UN of the, blah, 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 let's start again. The permanent representatives to the UN of the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, Rwanda, Israel, and Germany were among those who spoke with the Secretary General's Special Advisor on Genocide, Adama Dieng, Philippe Bolopian of Human Rights Watch, and Robert Kostro, who is director of the Museum of Polish History. Let me clarify something. That sentence that I read referring to the permanent representatives to the UN of the United States, Russia, United Kingdom, France, Rwanda, Israel, and Germany, that does not mean that those seven nations are the only countries in the UN. I think they're all general members of the General Assembly, and I think the author here may be referring to members of the current Security Council, comprised of 15 nations, 10 seats of which are rotating amongst the entire General Assembly, and of course 5 permanent members of the Security Council include the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, and France. The 5th member of the Security Council's of course, is mainland China, or the People's Republic of China. Okay, let's continue. Mr. Eliason said the event offered a chance to consider what must be done differently to protect people and build societies, quote, where tolerance trumps hatred, and stressed that excuses for turning a blind eye were disappearing. With pervasive instant communication and deepening international connections, as well as the knowledge that genocide results from creeping processes unfolding over time and of conditions that allow them to thrive, our challenge is to stop these processes and their enabling conditions at an early stage, Mr. Eliason said, adding that armed conflicts often create environments ripe for massive atrocities, but stressing that genocide also resulted from divisions fostered in peacetime. The idea that the international community must stand ready to protect populations from genocide and other atrocity crimes was reinforced by adoption of the Responsibility to Protect principle at the 2005 World Summit, and more needed to be done to operationalize that commitment. He said, "We need political will and political courage to move forward," pointing out that the UN was engaged in a process of bolstering its capacity to act early through the Secretary General's Human Rights Upfront Initiative, which promoted better coordination and decision-making. The director of the Memorial and State Museum Auschwitz-Birkenau, Piotr Siwiński, delivered the keynote address to the meeting, noting that it was probably one of the last anniversaries that would give the chance to host survivors. Mr. Siwiński said it was an important moment to look to the future and form a vision for the memory of the Holocaust. Auschwitz today served as, quote, testimony, symbol, and a place for education, he said, describing the camp's history and significance in the museum's efforts to reach out to a younger generation. Mr. Siwiński said protection of the site's authenticity for younger, less connected audiences was an essential part of his duties, and he was working hard to fuse the words of remaining survivors with the physical site where the killing took place. The representative of the African country of Rwanda described the overlap between the events of 70 years ago and of 20 years ago in his own country, asking, in the context of the Never Again pledge made after the Holocaust, why another genocide was allowed to happen. He, that representative, of course, is referring to the mid-90s massacre of several hundred thousand members of the, quote, wrong tribe, of a less favored African tribe within which shared space in the country of Rwanda with the tribe mostly involved in the massacring. Let's finish this up here. The year 2015 marked 70 years since the Holocaust. he said, but it was also 70 years since the creation of institutions that were designed to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. The question was whether those institutions were strong enough to prevent atrocities in the future, and he underlined the importance of political will and implementation of decisions and principles, like the responsibility to protect. Well, I'm going to have to... That is the end. Reading of both articles from the United Nations and their completion, I do have comments that I could make, but there's really not enough time. So I'll just leave it be at that and let that sit with you and percolate. I only have enough time to tell you, in reference to these articles, the phrase "never again," so oft repeated by both Jew and non-Jew, in reference only to Jews in the shadow of World War II's Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust, that phrase "never again" must apply to everyone. There is no excuse for anyone, including Israeli Jews, to commit such crimes against anyone else, even if they are not blatantly gassing to death the disfavored. Okay, it's time for me to sign off. I welcome you to return next Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And, of course, soon we're into the last two or three chapters of Freedom Sailors, the story of the first successful voyages of support vessels, non-military support vessels, to the Gaza Strip in 41 years, the first voyages in 41 years. That will be on the Saturday edition of this same name show, Mideast Migraine Show, every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Thank you. Thank you for listening in your blissful quietness. Thank you, Charles, for giving a call there, a call of support, and letting me know that you listen out there in Monterey, California. Bye.